in a small way, both losing and finding my voice as I go. But I promise I'll try to find it more than I lose it. And the other piece of business that I wanted to take care of just at the outset of the evening is, you know how much I love, if you have an electronic version of the Gemara, I support your bringing an iPad or a laptop. I'd love it if we could put phones away and spend time, an hour and a half together, just here over Gemara. If there's any emergencies, then, of course, you know, I'm willing to understand that someone's waiting for a call about some kind of emergency. It's wonderful, but the culture, my daughter told me in high school, this is what the Gemara teachers are telling them. So I'm passing it along to you, and I would appreciate it just because it can be, for me, a little bit of a distraction. I'm sorry if it's not for you, and you can multitask in such a way, but I'm having a little bit of the on that level, multitasking within the confines of Gemara is fine, but I'd appreciate us being together in entirety. The other piece of business is that I want to just tell you, as really November starting, even though it's the end of October, I'll be away the week of November the 16th, and there will be class, and there will be a substitute teacher, Rabbi Sarah Zachariah, who some of you have met. She's a friend of mine, a colleague. She's starting to teach all over the neighborhood, actually. She's teaching for the 92nd Street Y. She's got other kinds of teaching. She's done years and years and years of Gemara teaching at rabbinical schools and in high schools, and was a curriculum builder. So she'll come and she'll substitute for me when I am not here that week. So wanted to give you that heads up as November rolls around. And off we go. So it is really...
Isn't the gala on a Wednesday night?
That's right. We should also say that by way of business. You're right.
Wednesday night, so that means your 16th isn't the right date.
No, the week of the 16th, I said.
Oh.
So the 16th,
no
the week of the 6th. You have no class on the 12th because that's the gala, and everybody's obviously
right.
Encouraged to come to the gala. And then the following week, which is the 19th, the Wednesday,
is
Rabbi Sarah.
And then the following week is Erev Thanksgiving. We usually don't meet.
Oh.
That's our
okay, good. So if that's the tradition.
Thanksgiving.
Right,
no,
people are going.
We change the tradition. We are not celebrating the way
the women might not want to change.
Yeah, no, my family would appreciate that very greatly, I'm sure. And if that's what.
So we just,
if that's been what's
that
happened for the last 2 years, Amy will also say that there's a chazaka.
We cannot win.
all right, so. So here we are. We are at the beginning of Megillah, and last week I gave a broader introduction about the first parak of the Megillah, the first parak of Mishnah particularly, and I did some thematics. I just want to get right into some details tonight and tell you that the first Mishnah said you can read on more than just the 14th and the 15th. Remember, we made what was called in Gemara terms a ribui. We expanded the possibility under the law by reading a verse of Scripture, not Torah in this case, but from the Ketuvim, from the writings part of the Bible, wherefrom we are learning mitzvot, and mitzvot that Jews must keep, defining all of Scripture beyond Torah as places where we can really look to for mitzvot in our lives. And we said the ribui is... we can read this on the 11th, 12th, and 13th. We said, no, not the 17th, 18th, not the 16th, 17th. Because we don't go farther the other way. Lo yoter. But we can read it on the 11th, 12th, 13th due to the circumstances of people from villages who don't have expert readers and might not have the requisite group to read it. We need to allow them to hear Megillah in the market. Hear Megillah on Beit Din days. I expanded the notion that many learn in the Mishnah that those days that Jews came together were simply market days, because you need to come to market to buy the food, to go back to make your feasts. You need to come to marketplaces. You need to come to cities where markets are thriving and bustling. But the other piece of business that Jews did on those days was to organize themselves into batei din, into the beit din structure, into the small court that you needed to bring matters to judges to adjudicate all kinds of what we would, I guess, consider anything from claims to lawsuits. So, the ribui came from really one verse, but there was a second verse offered as the verse we should use to actually increase the number of days that we could read the Megillah. And to hold those two verses as the possible verses from which we learn the ribui, that's where we want to start tonight. So let's talk about what those two are. The first verse that I might use to expand the number of dates that reading is permissible is a verse that says, "L'kayem et yimei Purim ha'ele b'zmanehem." I can establish these days of Purim.
What verse is that?
That verse is a verse from the Megillah, and it is Esther 9:31. Okay, so Esther 9:31. If I take that verse and I understand that L'kayem et yimei Purim ha'ele is referring to the days that are named in the Megillah, namely the 14th and the 15th, I'm fine. But b'zamanehem comes as a word to allow me to make such a thing as called a ribui. I expand the legal possibilities by reading the verse closely. The word b'zamanehem, in its particular form, will allow me to read even more expansively than simply just mentioning it's one more day of reading, or even two. I take the word b'zamanehem with the yud and the hem as opposed to b'zmanam, and I learn not only two more days, but I learn three, according to the way that we learn the Gemara. Bismanehem. Could have said Bisman. Could have said Bismanam. But it says Bismanehem, given that I have possibilities that the word could have been expressed in otherwise terser lashon, terser language. I look at it, I examine it, I say it's an expansive language, and thusly I make the ribui. Gemara comes along and says, Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmani says, no, wait a minute. I don't need that verse for this ribui, for this expansive read of the days upon which I can read the Megillah. I have another verse. I have an alternative verse. The alternative verse that I use to learn that you can read on different days is a verse that says, "Kayamim asher nachu vahem ha'yehudim." That verse is Esther 9:22, instead of the verse 9:31. I read the 22nd verse as indicating that I can make an expansion on reading not only the 14th and 15th in terms of the Megillah reading. I can have these people who need to hear it read the 11, 12, 13 because of the expression ka yamim. It just doesn't say yamim. I have the kaf. One letter, we talked about Professor Heinemann's notion of holy word games, holy letter games, the rabbi's version of those word and letter games being the holiest that he's seen in an ancient textual world, that one letter, kaf, can come to expand the number of days that I have to read the Megillah. All of the sociological reasons that we gave, and all of the practical reasons we gave, and all of the historical evidence that we have that it could have been done differently, all tied into what? One letter. Ha! Just like when my little one says, oh, we can eat that because it has a Hebrew letter on it. Go figure. You know? One Hebrew letter can change the world in terms of a piece of candy. That's the power of that one letter for that Rav. We're at a point where, in fact, we already went through and we saw on 2A4, if you're looking at the art scroll with me, that not the 16th and 17th comes from the fact Velo Ya'avor is written in the Megillah. You shouldn't go past this day. That's verse 927 in Esther. The verse continues, Velo Ya'avor Lihiyot Osim Et Shnei Hayamim Ha'ele, and it shall not pass to observe these 2 days, the 14th and the 15th. Meaning, I can go the other direction, 11, 12, 13, in these cases that I explained to you in the Mishnah, where we have to have people from the villages come to hear the Megillah on the market days, on the Beit Din days. Ready? Market days mean Beit Din days. And I'm not going to allow it for the 16th and 17th because it says Lo Ya'avor in the Megillah as well. Note, the rabbis did not need to use verses in sequential order. The Gemara doesn't need to present verse 21, then 22, then 26, then 37. Where I have a tradition that has a verse in it, and a verse is, happens to be either from the same chapter or not from the same chapter, from one part of the Torah or from another part of the Torah, feature of rabbinic literature all over is that you don't need to worry about what comes before, what comes after. I read verses atomistically. I can read a part of a verse. I can take one letter in a word and learn the particular tradition, say it's its source, hold out it being the source, and then suggesting it's the source or suggesting it's not a source and it can't be used as a source and I disagree with that as the source. And then the Gemara could say, here's the source that I think really ought to be used, or the Gemara could say, yes, so you disagree it's the source. So new, what do you think is the source? And we're left with space on the page for the Rishonim, for other commentaries. Because sometimes they just don't give you the answer. That is where we hold. That's where we're holding. And if you're with me in the Art Scroll edition, we're on 2A4. And if you're in the Vilna Shas edition, we are on the wide lines where it says Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani. And we're going to get the famous question, my Tama. But we're going to get it, my Tama Lo. Why did he not say this? Why did he not hold by that verse? The verses being now in our heads, you either have two key words. The ribui was either from Bizmanehem, in their times, or the expansion of the law to read the 11, 12, 13 was for the word kayamim, like those days. Extra kaf. Gemara goes a little further to say, why didn't this guy accept that drosh? Why didn't this sage accept that? So it says, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani, my Tama lo amar mi bizmanehem. Can I understand the reason why Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani, who derives the Mishnah's ruling from Kayamim, would not say that it could be derived from bizmanehem in their times? The Gemara answers, Zman, Zmanam, Zmanehem, Lo Mashmale. It says, to expound on each of the three possible forms of the expression in their times, their time, their times, that's simply unacceptable to that rabbi. That's unacceptable. You thought you could parse a word in such a, I guess you'd call that a grammatical declension. Doesn't work. Gemara now asks the reverse question. Rav Shemin Bar Abba, my Tama lo amar mi kayamim, and this other Rav that we have, this other sage that we have, who wants to know, why can't I learn from kayamim, like the suggestion before? Gemara answers, Amar lach. Rav Shemin Bar Abba could answer you, Hahu l'dorot hu dichtiv. Classic rabbinic answer. That term, like today's, was written in reference to future generations. If you tell me that I have to learn the ribui of 11, 12, 13, in addition to days 14 and 15 of Adar, as days I can read, you're taking away from me the possibility of using that verse to learn a different halachic norm, learn a different tradition. And you've taken away the possibility of not only the whole matter of making the dates expensive, but you're losing the ability to hold Jews accountable every generation past the one in Shushan. Because that's the verse I need to prove that this goes on for generations. That pretty much stops the conversation. Your rabbinic conversation stopper. Let me tell you about it again. You didn't look at the grammar of that word, and you didn't see that you could parse it into three very unique words in order to learn days 11, 12, 13. No, he didn't like that way of looking at the grammar. That's not the way anybody looks at grammar, and that's not an acceptable way of looking at grammar. We do a lot here with grammar. Trust me, I'm part of the rabbis too. But I'm not letting you get away with Bezimanehem being such a grammatical kind of limud, such a grammatical type of learning. So then, what's the deal? Why not Kayamim? That one. You can't take that one either. Why? How am I going to make everybody responsible, generation after generation of the Jewish people? Well, case closed. Gemara doesn't want to continue fighting. Because if I can't make future generations responsible, I've lost all power. And that verse, according to some traditions, that this Rav was holding, really was the linchpin verse for future generations being chayav the Kriya of the Megillah. That is one way to think about why the Gemara is now going to turn its attention to ask who's really the author and step away from the whole conversation.
Does anybody ever question this concept that a word can only be applied to one interpretation?
No, that's part of it.
How everybody does Shakespeare. You find 100 meanings with each word. Why do we have to be so rigid in terms of one word for one thing and therefore it's taken and you can't possibly use it for another interpretation? This seems intellectually constricting.
It's so intellectually you're right that, and I feel the same way, that sometimes the rabbi's hermeneutical rules seem to lock you in lockstep to a way of reading the text. In other words, if you want to read like the rabbis, that everything can have one drush, and systemically you really want to hold by that, and agree that that's the way they read, then you're kind of in lockstep. But there are a couple of intellectually incredible, wonderful, you know, just delightful observations we can make. At the same time that the rabbis really hold that, they're including in any which way, shape, or form, the kind of traditions that major sages hold with the same words all at the same time. If they really only believe you could learn one thing, they'd give us an apodictic book, they'd give us a codific book, and say, from this word, I learn only this, and by the way, don't record any minority opinions, and by the way, don't really hold that that's a tradition, and then give an example that someone actually did Jewish law like that, because there'll be times when that happens. In other words,
when they want to
they give you the possibilities that exist in the world. And sometimes when the Gemara ends a conversation, unlike the way I presented it just before, I could present it a different way. Since the Gemara hasn't resolved which verse is truly the verse from which we learn the 11, 12, 13, it seemed like a good place to stop and turn its attention, said the editors, to an issue of, oh, now that you mention generations, let me tell you about one of our greatest teachers of the generations to come, which is exactly where we're going. So I don't have to interpret it the way that I did. You don't have to either. And it could be that both traditions actually are alive and well. But the hermeneutical, the rhetorical argument that I need it and I only am going to apply it to one tradition gets back to the point that it is rhetoric, it is a closed community, and maybe everybody, we want them to agree. So at the same time it's strict, it's also about creating culture and creating a reading community that agrees deeply on a way to read the text. And we know that textual reading is partly what defines who's in and who's out.
I don't know why they are going through this, because Zman, Zmanam, and Zmanem, they are all plural in Hebrew, like Shamayim, like Mayim, like everything else. There are a lot of words that even the individual is plural. And Zmanam and Zmanem is Shayachut, is the belonging of. So the way to translate it and make it easy is that any person can read it whenever he has the time to read it. Bezmanem, when you have the time, do it. I think that's probably more free to those community to do it. And there is minhag to do it maybe before because of the market day, Zman is plural from the beginning, so the sentence starts with plural.
Okay, if you were in the Beit Midrash, maybe someone would have really liked your argument.
I'm not talking about the rabbi, but by the grammar.
No, maybe someone there didn't say that, or maybe someone did and they didn't record it. I can't say, but this is the way it played out. You could also get philological and say that Mishu Shezamin, he's invited, right? And when we have Zimun, when we have the introductory kind of words to say, come, let's bless, because we have the chevra together, whether you're 3 people or 10 people before Birkat HaMazon, you could learn from there that we said we took this opportunity when we had the requisite number of people, and since we said that in Masechet Brachot, I could say over here in by the Megillah that if I had the requisite number of people, I should make a Zimun, and we should make a Bracha, and we should read it. Lots of ways to go that seem to be, in rabbinic parlance, on track and makbil, on track and parallel. The Gemara oftentimes doesn't present those things. We've said before, sometimes the Rishonim say those things, sometimes they don't. Sometimes that's our chidush in the Beit Midrash. That's our possibility. So if you don't see why they didn't say it, it's because you needed to right now.
these verses are about the celebration of the holiday of Purim. They're not about the reading of the Megillah, so that the argument about Zman Ahem and the first letter Kuh is really goes back even it's even more of a stretch in a sense, because it's not talking about the reading of the Megillah. There is no reference in the Book of Esther to the reading of the Megillah. That's something the rabbis decided on. Once they decide on the reading of the Megillah, then they begin arguing about the proof text and which proof text to use, even though there's nothing in here that says read the Megillah on Purim.
Nice. So that is part of the reason why we're about to see which teacher really taught that we have to do this anyway.
Well, what is not said is we're making this up because we want to read the Megillah on Purim.
Right.
And we have to find a way to justify it.
Okay. And who's going to justify that? Who's going to teach us that? None other than Rabbi Akiva, who I mentioned last time. And that's where the Gemara is going to turn right now. Let's turn that. 2a4. Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Bar Bar Chana said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Zu divrei Rabbi Akiva, steam ta'a. This ruling of our Mishnah is of the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, the anonymous one. Didarish zaman, zamanam, zamanehem. He had the drush on that word zamanehem. Aval chachamim omrim. But the sages said, Ein korino ta'ela bizmana. One may read the Megillah only in its proper time. A couple of wonderful things I said last week, that you had several named sages already, but to come to a place where such a mitzvah according to the fact that we're using verses from Ketuvim, this is where I will now go the opposite direction. Of course you can use verses from Ketuvim, I said. Of course you can use verses from writings. Well, they full well know that they're making a mitzvah here that itself didn't exist particularly in the way they're saying to do it right now in the Megillah. They know that, but they are using verses and references, as Herb just offered. And who other than the great Rabbi Akiva really taught this? And his drush was on Zmanam Zmanehem. That was the verse that he used to prove it. And that seems to us to be an important and very noteworthy fact. And by the way, we often give the Stam Mishnah, the Mishnah that's not with a named sage, who would we expect to hear that's really an opinion of? Rebbe. Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi. But this is a particular moment where they say, huh, this was a tradition that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the editor of the Mishnah, writer of some Mishnayot, circa 200 CE, that Rebbe had this as a tradition from Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva steam ta'a. So let's stop and pause there for a moment, because I don't know if anybody's ever really encountered that as a concept in Gemara, or to remind you, Akiva being the Stam, being the anonymous opinion, is an accepted idea in Mishnah. Even though we often say it's Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and some people in reading Mishnah might say, oh, you have a name sage, therefore probably the anonymous is the Chachamim, a majority opinion of sages, even as opposed to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who's often named among the name sages, with whom Chachamim, the sages, have an argument. But what is the concept of Akiva being the Stam? And we say the Stam. So when I say the Stam, I mean the unnamed opinion. In the Gemara, if I say the Stam, I'm not talking about Rabbi Akiva. I'm talking about a different layer of Gemara editing, and like Rav Asi was one of them. I'm not talking about the Gemara, the Talmudic production part. I'm talking about the Mishnah itself. We have a tradition that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in 200 really did compile, write, really is the anonymous voice of the Mishnah. But Rabbi Akiva, we have a tradition, and we accept the tradition, that Rabbi Akiva had either, I'll say it like this from noteworthy scholars who have asked these questions, Goldberg being one of them, Rabbi Akiva either had a Mishnah, kind of the same way that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi really has a full-out 63-tractate Mishnah of his own that's not necessarily organized exactly like this, or at least he had an outline of many traditions that were in enough of a Rosh HaPerek kind of form, beginning of a chapter, beginning of a Mishnah kind of form, that you could see exactly what his Mishnah looked like as when you heard it from those who had memorized it, because remember, it's passed on orally and not written down in its entirety. That the Chiddush of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, in 200, was to actually write down an entire Mishnah with the sages at Yavne. Rabbi Akiva's Mishnah was held mostly orally, as was so much textually in those times, in addition to whatever writings that we really had, like Torah Shebichtav, particularly written Torah, meaning our Tanakh, Torah itself. Year 35 to, you know, he's around when Bar Kokhba happens.
It's after 70, after the second temple.
Yeah. You know, it's at 130 something.
What does that mean in this mission?
So it means that there's an organized, codific, if not curricular plan by the great Rabbi Akiva, who created myriads of students, and particularly certain sages. And that when the Gemara comes and says, oh, that's an opinion of Rabbi Akiva, there's deep import, that we respect it deeply, that we have it from an age before. There's also other Mishnayot, there's other Mishnahs mentioned in the Mishnah. One of them being Mishnah Rishona, the first Mishnah. And when we get to an example where someone uses that phrase, I think we'll get to it down the line in our Masechta, we'll talk more about where that phrase appears and what that text really is. Again, we believe a little like with the Gemara, though I hesitate to compare it to the Talmud. There's an accepted Mishnah among certain sages. Maybe it's based on area you live in, maybe not. That is an early Mishnah, an early set of teachings that come to be a little bit more codific and organized around subject matter that pertains to damages, holiday celebrations, ceremonies, holiness codes, all these kinds of things. So we have evidence within the Mishnah of all these pieces. And here the Gemara is holding out that this was Rabbi Akiva who made this grammatical limud, this grammatical drush, this grammatical Torah happened to learn the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. And the sage's position is that one may read the Megillah only in its proper time. That is, the proper time articulated by the verse, the 14th and the 15th of the month. So the Gemara is going to challenge Rabbi Yochanan's statement. Remember, it was Rabbi Bar Bachana who said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan that it was Akiva. Meitevei, I'm challenging that. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Ematai. Rabbi Yehuda said, when really are the villagers allowed to read this Megillah? Earlier than the 14th. V'zeman shashanim ketiknan. Only during that period when the years are fixed properly by the Beit Din. V'yisrael shiruyin alad matan. And the Jewish people reside in their own land. Aval v'zeman hazeh. But in this time, in our time, in the current era, ho ilu mistaklin ba, since people look at the date on which the Megillah is read, ein korin ota ela bismana, one may read the Megillah only in its proper time, meaning what? That people in foreign lands are looking to the reading of the Megillah as a very consequential date. If I know when the reading of the Megillah is, I know exactly when my Pesach Seder needs to fall. Because if it's the 14th of the month, a month later I have Pesach. Calendrical computations were of utmost significance to the rabbis. Working out the calendar and its dates was of very significant rabbinic versus other movements kind of controls on the Jewish people. They don't accept the read of people who say that from the Sabbath in Pesach is not the second day of the holiday. They want to wait till Shabbat, some of these people. The word Sabbath can be something different than Sabbath. Doesn't have to be waiting till the Sabbath in terms of the Omer period starting during Passover. We, the rabbis, declare this is the day to start the Omer, and thus the day to have Shavuot, 50th day later. They were very particular about who sets the time, what time one should do Pesach, because you did not want a chance eating chametz. You couldn't chance that. For them, that was the most serious, serious issue in the world. And so, when the Jewish people reside in their own land, it's only during that period when the years are fixed properly by the Beit Din and the Jewish people reside in their land that I can really have people shift around. Otherwise, I need to have everybody do it exactly on the right day. So there's no flubbing the calendar. Gemara is now going to show how the Braita refutes Rabbi Yochanan's position. Rabbi Yehuda, Aliba Deman, whose opinion does Rabbi Yehuda, the Tana of the Braita, follow in regard to the dispute between Rabbi Akiva and the sages? Rabbi Akiva says, what? Bizman, Bizmanam, Bizmanehem, I can read the Megillah 11, 12, 13 based on the verse in the Megillah. And the Chachamim say what? One may read the Megillah only in its proper time. If you say that he follows the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, Eilema Aliba de Rabbi Akiva, if Rabbi Yehuda, the Tana, the Braita, who said that only during the period when the years are fixed properly and the people reside in Israel can they play with the calendar, but if they live outside of Israel, they can't play with the calendar. If you say that he follows the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, afilu bizman hazeh ita lahayta kanta, because according to Rabbi Akiva, this ordinance permitting villagers to read earlier than the 14th applies even in the current era. If you say it goes to Rabbi Akiva, if he's holding by Rabbi Akiva, it's okay to read 11th and 12th and 13th anytime. But if you say that he's holding by the Chachamim, right? No, you can't. Because they said you can't in this time. That we don't live there. So, Eila love, I'll leave with the Rabbanan. Surely then Rabbi Yehuda must follow the opinion of the sages who dispute Rabbi Akiva's opinion. And yet he maintains that at any rate, during the period when the years are fixed properly by the Beit Din and the Jewish people reside in our own land, we may in fact read the Megillah earlier than the 14th. This contradicts the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan, who holds that according to the sages, the Megillah may never be read before the 14th of Adar. Tiyuvta de Rabbi Yochanan Tiyuvta. This refutation of the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan is indeed an absolute refutation.
I'm confused. We talked about how the timelines are all off here. The writing of the things that happened before, but how do they even pretend to quote Rabbi Akiva when he was, 30 CE to 100 CE or whatever he was, and this was so many... How do they quote someone?
Well, right.
I mean, it's one thing just to say it. I mean, you can say it so the Gemara kept getting revised and redone.
They do that all the time.
I know. But they're actually putting it in someone else's name.
There are arguments between two people who don't exist.
Who don't exist or never knew each other.
Right.
But it just drives you crazy.
Well, this is the kind of the
It's what Rabbi Akiva would have said.
Right.
How do you do
it? It could be the inherited oral tradition was passed down so carefully by the school of thought.
But he never commented about the Megillah, and he never commented about Purim. It's just what he would have said had he...
He probably did. See, that's the thing. This is saying that what he did is he taught when he was alive in his Mishnah that you could expand the dates of reading to the 11, 12, 13.
The Megillah took place after this.
No, the Megillah took place before in the biblical era.
14, 15, in the biblical
era.
Okay, so he would have said it then. Okay.
Yeah, so he would have been able to know the tradition of
so
Megillah. And people would have been able to learn from him according to the way he drushed things out, and it seemed logical that he had such a grammatical thing. So if they really did, sometimes they will, though, in your spirit, say, would Rabbi Akiva or any sage they want to ask, would he really say that? Or I have a different tradition where he holds the exact opposite. And then the Gemara is really introducing what we consider to be, the ability to question transmission, right? There's a massive amount of literature on transmission and questions of transmission. People like David Kramer, and especially like Professor Neusner, have gotten into issues of transmission. Professor Neusner holds the far end of the spectrum, who says that basically the editors decided in whose name everything should be said. That's the far end of the spectrum. And for whatever reason, they wanted to have multi-generational traditions arguing one with the next so that you, in a certain way, felt, I don't think Rabbi Neusner would say it like this in his books, but this for sure is the spirit that I see in his books for young students, because he writes those too. So that is somewhat of the license to say that a generation, 10 generations later, can argue with a generation who came ten generations before them.
So he dismisses the whole oral passing on.
So he really doesn't like the idea that you can have attributable teachings, and transmission thusly is more, in a sense, like a group of great axioms, codes that didn't have a lot of trustworthy names. He pulls out some kernels to say it seems like this person's traditions hold a little bit. This person's traditions hold a little bit tighter than that person's, and then others really feel like, wait a minute, you can really understand why certain rabbis held the way they did, and even if they look like they are not exactly drushing things the same way, one verse of the Torah to the next, why they would have the ability to be so flexible halachically, and there's no reason to discount the fact that it might just be Rav Akiva. And that you had certain kinds of schools where you had expansive enough hermeneutics, even if we're a little strict with how we read, to allow for different traditions in the names of their sages. So, it's good questions, and Rabbi Akiva, I want to hang on for a moment. As I said last week, he's just a person that we have to know in order to understand Judaism as it developed for the Mishnah itself. And in that vein, I just have a little bit of supplemental about Rabbi Akiva, so take one of these and pass it along. Flip it around the tail. This is from a book called Sefer HaAgadah. It is the book of Midrashim. It's translated as the book of legends, but legends doesn't do justice to the Agadah proper. Capital A-G-G-A-D-A-H. Okay. Sorry. The nice thing about Sefer HaAgadah, Jay, can you point out, if you reach out your right arm, you basically see Sefer HaGadah in both English and Hebrew on the shelf behind you to the left of the Zohar. Both of those. So if you hold that up, that's the Hebrew version, and the English version of Sefer HaGadah. Okay? So, the Sefer HaGadah is a massive work produced by Bialik and Ravnitsky, Bialik being a major literary force, Ravnitsky being his partner in the production here, of all of the different weavings in of Midrash and literary traditions of our sages, and what's interesting about their project is it's a little bit like Talmud in and of itself. That book, even though it pretends to list all of the different sources about any one given subject or sage or biblical character, what they've done is they've kind of done their own weaving of sources, so you really don't know if you're reading Midrash A or Midrash C and the way they've woven the story, because if the timeline is filled in by this other Midrash or this other story, they've kind of taken from that story and they've put it in, they've made a nice narrative happen, but it really is a collection of our sources in a beautifully organized way, and the footnotes that were then done to show you where the sources come from when it comes to any given topic or any given sage will allow you to kind of do the reverse engineering of picking it apart and say, okay, I understand that this story that I'm reading about Rabbi Akiva might be a combination of the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud all at the same time.
Written when was it
written? 1908 to 1911.
So at the turn of the century, when they were scared that people were losing a certain type of literacy, it was going to be a setup also to help people understand Agnon and to really appreciate all of his work later on, that it got as much publishing momentum as it did, so that you could go back to some sources and have them at your fingertips. It was published with nikudot, with vowels, so that texts could be articulated and pronounced in a certain way, so that as modern Hebrew developed, we wouldn't forget the kind of lingua de Tanakh, the classic Hebrew midrashic language, and beautiful perush commentary on all kinds of things. And if you go to a part, since you have it open, go to a part there that's kind of post on a table of contents, and you see that it lists like Abraham, Sarah, all these biblical characters, and then the sages.
And they have the deeds of the sages.
And then they have the deeds of the sages, and you'll get each sage, just you can read that one name down after the next. And then they have a chapter, you know, kind of a, I think they translated there, man and his needs,
well,
or something like
that. Israel and the nations of the world, the land of Israel, language, exile, redemption, the days of the Messiah, and the time to come.
All right, so wonderful, wonderful, important book.
Man and his needs.
Right, wonderful, important book to have. Great literature. Rabbi Akiva is highlighted in this section that I gave you, and different traditions about him extend for pages. The story that I told was that which was number 146. Turn the page. What were Akiva's beginnings? It is said up to the age of 40, he had not yet studied a thing. One time, while standing by the mouth of a well in Lida, he inquired, "Who hollowed out this stone?" And was told, "Akiva, haven't you read in scriptures that the water wears away stone? It was water from the well falling upon it constantly day after day." At that, Rabbi Akiva asked himself, "Is my mind harder than this stone? I will go and study at least one section of Torah." He went directly to his schoolhouse, and he and his son began reading from a child's tablet. Rabbi Akiva took hold of one end of the tablet, and his son of the other end. The teacher wrote down Aleph and Bet for him, and he learned them. Aleph and Tetav, and he learned them. The book of Leviticus, and he learned it. He went on studying until he learned the whole Torah. Then he went and sat before Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Joshua. "My masters," he said to them, "reveal the sense of Mishnah to me." When they told him one halacha, he went off to reason with himself. This Aleph, he wondered, what was it written for? That Bet, what was it written for? This teaching, what was it uttered for? He kept coming back, kept inquiring of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua until he reduced his teachers to silence. All the 12 years that Rabbi Akiva was with Rabbi Eliezer paid little attention to him, so that when Rabbi Akiva offered his first clinching argument to him, Rabbi Joshua quoted the verse, "There is the army you paid no attention to, now go out and fight it." Rabbi Shimon and Elazar said, "I shall tell you a parable to illustrate what Rabbi Akiva did. He was like a stonecutter hacking away at mountains. One time he took his pickaxe in his hand, went and sat on top of the mountain, and began to chip small stones from it. Some men came by and asked him, 'What are you doing?' 'I mean to uproot the mountain and cast it into the Jordan. Can you possibly do such a thing?' 'Yes,' he continued hacking away until he came to a big boulder. He placed an iron claw under it, pried it loose, uprooted it, and cast it into the Jordan. And then he spied another, even bigger boulder, placed an iron claw under it, and cast it into the Jordan, saying, 'Your place is not here but there.'" So I just want to give you a sense that, as I said last week, if this is your first Gemara class ever, so it's your first Gemara class. If you've only gotten to chip away, you've chipped away. If you get to a boulder and you iron claw it, you should spy another. Rabbi Akiva is held out as this incredible, having lived a lifetime without a word of Torah. And there's just something profound that he then becomes the kind of Rebbe, the kind of rabbi to raise up disciples in our tradition.
Is it without a word of Torah or without even knowing how to read?
Without even knowing Aleph Bet.
Without knowing how to read.
Yeah. Illiterate. He was literate in the ways of shepherding.
I just realized where the phrase Oker Harim comes from. I never knew that.
Oh, then that's it.
The Oker Harim comes from here.
What does that mean?
To uproot mountains.
Someone who really can brush, you know, can turn things around.
I didn't read the book of Leviticus before Horatio.
Oh, good question. What's that? The book of Leviticus, in a Jewish curricular sense, up until our era, is the first book of Torah that children learn. Now, there are a couple of different reasons, and I'll just give a couple. First of all, one of the nice things about Leviticus is you have animals. If you think about the number of children's books that have animals as main characters, then it's easy to understand. It's a very, very accessible book. What's that?
They also like Adam and Eve and the rainbow and the Noah and the ark, though, right?
What?
The animals are being slaughtered all the time.
by way of understanding that you have a religious system, too, where you have to pay God in order to expiate sins, up until quite modern times, for our people, even with the Rambam's questioning why we need sacrifices, there is a deep sense of return one day to the Beit HaMikdash and the notion of being able to really be close to our Lord through the act of sacrificial worship. The fact of the matter is that Leviticus is very easy in terms of system and very self-oriented in terms of if I make a mistake, I have to say I'm sorry. Most children who are 4, 5, and 6 years old, I would even argue 7, 8, or 9, and I won't pontificate tonight, but perhaps another time for a lecture, are faced with some of the most complex human dynamics stories in the world if they're given the book of Genesis as the first Chumash of Torah to read in their education. Let's just say there was not a consensus going my direction on that matter in the school world. I just simply don't believe that kindergartners, first graders, and second graders are equipped to understand why Abraham passes off his wife as a sister and why God has to destroy the entire world and live with a God like that. I think that they can live with a God who says, I'm finding you a way to say you're sorry. I'm finding you a way to say you're guilty. And for a long time, that's what we did as Jews. We showed them Leviticus first. Thank you for the open door for a second of my critical commentary on our curricular approaches these days. The notion that he learned Leviticus first was also because of the Parsha Kedoshim. Another one of the major issues about what it is we believe in as Jews is to be somewhat of a separate cultural building enterprise. And Parsha Kedoshim really does that. It really says you have to keep kosher. It really says that you have ethical laws to really maintain in its explication of what others might consider the mainstay of the first commandments, meaning the Ten Commandments. It really is not a matter of the Ten Commandments that teaches you how to live your life. It's the Kedoshim piece. Kedoshim says you should have respect enough for your parental unit. You should also really deeply respect the law at the same time and live a Sabbath life. Live a life of the rhythm of Sabbath. Ethical conduct, eating in a state of holiness. And for that reason, too, Leviticus was really concentrated upon in early on curricula. Again, what do you have in Parsha Kedoshim to make it true to form by way of what kids can relate to and how they could attach sounds to the different animals? There's a whole list of animals in Parsha Shmini, right? And Parsha Shmini, with all its list of what's kosher and what's not, is a fantastic expose. Now, you also had people who needed to do the jobs of being ritually inclined priests in Leviticus, and make sure all the work was done properly. And there were some warnings, like early OSHA warnings. Don't drink on the job. People had to be very careful in those times not to be even injured in the slightest. So Leviticus goes through any number of major, major life lessons for children. And Akiva obviously got through it pretty quickly and then went on to myriads more and the entire Mishnah. But
so what do they do in the class? Kadosh, for example, is a section rather graphic description of various deviant sexual behavior, bestiality.
What they do with it pretty much is to just make it about rules. Kids don't, well, it's kind of like current trends in sexuality education. So if a child asks, who can't marry who? And you say, well, someone from the family can't marry someone from the family. The child's not going to ask more at that stage of their development. For what reason? Or, you know, exactly for details. Maybe some exceptional children get to that stage before others in the group, and you kind of have to deal with some of those matters. The reality is that it sets forth just...
But they don't skip over, they actually discuss it.
You have a lot of laws. One critique of Gemara teaching that includes matters of human sexuality or areas of Leviticus that includes human sexuality that are not discussed openly enough in developmentally appropriate ways in yeshivas ad hayom hazeh, to this very day, is that we do encounter certain kinds of habits of human behavior and laws, strictures, restrictions that we can't simply expect kids to understand without some degree of true education. But on the other hand, there are times in a child's life when you don't have to go further and you don't have to get too much information out. You just simply know these are the rules. Because in the ancient world, it might have been that you had families and you had different kind of marital structure. So in the ancient world, particularly, you might have needed to know that. And in the rabbinic world, you needed to know that. So when it came to Levitical rules about who marries who, they were very important because you were worried about the status of your offspring. And so they were pretty blasé about such matters.
I wouldn't be too happy if my father was 6 years.
I would think they gloss over it in 5 or 6.
I would think that about 5 or 6 probably it didn't happen. And just like when we teach Chumash Bereishit, you know, we go into some of the more complex dynamics of family life, but we might skip the rape of Dina. Yeah. It comes a certain point, though, where kids are really, really feeling like something's kept from them. And I will tell you from reports of students who wound up either in my office or come to me now even. I literally had just one of these conversations the other day with a young bar mitzvah student, you know, whose parsha contained something rather, worrisome for parents, and naturally just skip over it and no one's discussed it. They came out right out with the question to me.
This was not a day school kid.
This is a child. And day school kids, too, though, come to my office all the time over the years and say, you know, oh, I see that the teacher's skipping these. So kids who become aware in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and they've got state-mandated sexuality curricula, and they're encountering all kinds of things in the text, are really ready for some conversations at some point. We're not talking about, you know, very small youths, young youths. Okay. Let's move back into the text. So this is some other Rabbi Akiva traditions. It's not all of them, but I wanted you to have them. And as the Gemara unfolds and we meet different sages, I encourage people to go use the resources we have on the library shelves. The Sefer Haggadah is a wonderful place to read about the different sages. They're listed in the Deeds of the Sages section in Sefer Haggadah. The other piece I want to mention before we leave just here and continue along is that there's obviously a discussion going on about the era that they live in Israel and the era that they live outside of the land of Israel. And remember, one of the themes that I introduced in this Masechta is the whole trying to understand diaspora reality. How does living in the diaspora differ than the land of Israel? And especially when it comes to days of doing holidays. And not only from the Yom Tov Rishon Sheni, from the 2 days of Yom Tov perspective, but Purim itself. And am I going to allow for an expansive reading of the Megillah on different days of the market when Jews are not living in their land and really in control of their calendar and in control of their court systems? And how does diaspora living impact the reality of our celebrations, our sociological reality as Jewish community? That question comes up time and again. And it will come up time and again. Do we pay a certain price for that? Do we gain benefit from that? Is it just different? So that's a trope within the Gemara already here that we should notice. Let's now, just a little bit of repetition of all those things, and let's move to a different now, inyan, a different subject, connected to our Mishnah, of course, on 2B1. Flip the page. Right-hand side, if you're with me in the English. And about halfway, I'm going to Krakim Hamukafim. So where is that in terms of lines? That is about, what is it, like 12, 13 lines down if you're in the, if you're on the Diffus, if you're on the Vilna. Or it's probably at the, in Steinsaltz, a whole new paragraph.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Krakim Hamukafim Choma Miyamot Yehoshua Bin Nun Korim B'Chamisha Asar. So who reads on the 15th? Let's now talk about the 15th. Cities that were surrounded by walls at the time of Joshua the son of Nun. They read the Megillah on the 15th of Adar. Now we said last week, Ma Kesher, what's the connection here? Right? And what was the reason given in short form?
They don't need to go places.
They don't need to go places. But moreover, in one line so far we've heard, they go back to the time of Joshua ben Nun to be a little bit respectful of Eretz Yisrael. They want to get the respect of Eretz Yisrael into this picture of the land of Israel. Let's see what that means. Let's see if, you know, if indeed it plays out. Mina Hanemili. From where do we know, from where are these things known? From where do we know these things? From where in Scripture does it really state? It doesn't explicitly state anything about walled cities. The Gemara gives the scriptural source. Amar Rava. Rava says the following. The Amar Kra. What's a Kra?
Kuf.
Scripture. Kuf Resh Aleph means a verse. The Amar Kra, a part of a verse. Scripture says, because what do you do with Scripture? You put it into the Mikra, that which should be read. And a Kra is a verse in this case. The Amar Kra is Scripture. Al Kena Yudim HaPrazim HaYoshvim Ba'arei HaPrazot. Therefore, the Jews of unwalled places who dwell in unwalled cities make the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of gladness, and that is Esther 9:19. Paruz, literally, if you could say, means scattered all over, like Vikarev Pizurenu, right? Paruz, Pizar, a little bit of flexibility in roots, right? And you have this Midfarazim ba'arba asar. Now, since the verse specifies that in unwalled cities, Purim is celebrated on the 14th of Adar, Mukafin b'chamisha asar, it implies that in walled cities, Purim is celebrated on the 15th of Adar. Wait, does that sound like sound logic?
I don't see.
Can someone make the logical argument from that statement?
Well, we were told it had to be the 14th or the 15th before the 11th, 12th, and 13th.
Ah,
so if you go back to that.
So there's the argument for the logical part, for anybody who wants logic to come into play. Since we had the 14th and 15th mentioned in the Megillah, and the unwalled cities were the 14th, then obviously walled cities are what's implied in the 15th. Now, that's still not entirely logical. Because I'm adding the dimension of what? I'm adding the dimension of walled cities. Just before I was talking about villages. I could have said unwalled cities and villages. I didn't have to say walled cities. But okay, I'll accept the fact that we're talking about walled cities. Let's push further. Gemara questions whether it's necessarily the verse's implication. Ve'ema prazim ba'arba'asar, but one could say that unwalled cities celebrate Purim on the 14th. Mukafin klal klal lo. And the residents of walled cities don't have to celebrate Purim at all. You know? Like, if you're going to specify the celebration of Purim is for people in unwalled cities, then let me go with the svara, let me go with the thought. Maybe people in walled cities have no reason to celebrate at all. That's the verse's corollary. Gemara rejects that possibility. The law of Yisrael, Nihu. Are the residents of walled cities not Jews? How can they be exempt from Purim? You're going to tell me that some people have obligations and other people don't have the obligation? The Ode, and more. Let me prove it to you from this other part of the verse. Mehodu v'ad Kush Kativ. It's written from Hodu to Kush. And since the festival of Purim is accepted in all of Ahasuerus' provinces, from Hodu to Kush, that certainly had to include walled cities, goes the thinking of most of the Rishonim. The Gemara poses another challenge. Ve'ema parazim ba'ar besar, but one could say that unwalled cities celebrate Purim on the 14th. Mukafin ba'ar besar uv'chamesar, and the walled cities celebrate Purim on both the 14th and the 15th. That if you live in a walled city and you're a part of the tradition that waited a little bit until the village, you know, the people in the outlying areas finished their fighting and then only you came, that you've got to celebrate both. You celebrate the days that your brothers and sisters won the battle outside of your protected walled cities and your more enlightened places, and you now have both of them to celebrate. Why can't you say that if you're already going to be trying to figure out from the verses? Kedichti v'hiot osim et yom arba asar l'chodesh adar ve'et yom chamisha asar v'chol shana. Because it says, you should observe the 14th day of the month of Adar and the 15th day of the same month every year. And that apparently includes a two-day festival lasting through the 14th and the 15th of Adar. So, if I have a walled city, why shouldn't I? It specified unwalled for the reason of saying they only have maybe one. But walled city Jews have two. Oh, that can't be. E hava katav et yom arba asar v'chamisha asar. If the verse would have written the 14th day and the 15th day, without the word what? Aleph Tav intervening, the et comes along to kind of separate. Kedekaamrat, as you suggested, hashta dichtivim yom arba asar ve'et yom chamisha asar, but now that it's written with this ve'et in between, to separate the 2 days, ata et ufasik, et comes and interposes a break between the two, hani barba asar v'hani b'chamisha asar. These on the 14th and those on the 15th.
Or it's just that they're together, the 14th and the 15th. I mean, you could read it any way you want, then.
You could, except that it wants to say that the extra word, ve'et, comes to separate the 2 days as being distinct, and one is for the walled cities, and one is for the unwalled cities.
Yes, and Mondays and Tuesdays. Yeah. Because
it would
be linked together.
Can I ask you to clarify something for a minute? Were they reading the Megillat Esther during the temple period?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question. So
the implication here is that they didn't have already a tradition.
Yeah, no, they have a tradition. They have a tradition that Mordechai and other prophets, already as Anshei Knesset Gedola, already as men of the Great Assembly, told you as a Jew, you are now going to keep Purim every year, and you're going to read the Megillah. That's the tradition. Whether or not walled cities do it on a different day or do it for 2 days, you see here that the discussion was at least reported. Could be after the fact. It could have already been decided, and we could get the whole discussion as a matter of history book. That's an argument that some people have about the second Megillah. Or it could be that they're right now working out the whole issue. Because that now that they're inhabiting a place and they're on the move again, post-destruction. And what if there are Jews now who are going to reside in walled cities again? Or cities that were walled during the time of Yehoshua? So,
I mean, are we to conclude, say, in the first century BCE, they should have been reading the Megillah?
They were. We are accepting of the fact that when
they might have been reading it on the 15th in walled cities and on the 14th in villages and on the 12th or the 11th.
Correct.
And, so what are they trying to do here?
They're trying to give us
the logic.
They're either trying to give us the entirety of the thought, infusing some of the thinking about when and what we do with some of the issues that come along with it, as in, do we really allow that to continue because we really are not in control of our land anymore now that we're diaspora Jews? Do we allow that to happen? Do we have to get tighter in terms of our identity as a community and only read on the 14th and 15th and not have this 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 whole hullabaloo and leave Jews out there in the villages? Maybe that's going to urbanize the Jewish population a little bit more in some ways.
The focus then, you're implying that the focus is really we are in a transitional period.
You asked what are the possibilities? So you're making me think about what are the real possibilities. We talked a little bit about this last time, that part of the real tension going on here is that we're in a time of diaspora reality, having lost control of our land, knowing that urbanization stands somewhat over and against being diasporic out to the hinterlands of farming culture and non-concentrated, let's say, Jewish communal life, especially in lands not our own, in the Gaonic era, for sure, if some of the editorializing in the Gemara is much later even than the rabbinic period itself, but already in Sasanian Persia we have those issues. So yeah, I think there is major transition constantly going on in Jewish rabbinic parlance all the time, and they're dealing with from colonial reality of Roman colonialism to living under other authority and having our own infrastructure to the breakdown of certain parts of that community to the buildup of certain places in Israel again after we lose control or after we lose population centers.
Is it possible the implication of that is, are we going to see these same arguments brought to other parts in the Talmud, to other needs of the rabbis to make fences around this transitional phase and then the next phase of settled life for Jewish communities? So is it just to Esther, or there's a whole lot more?
No, you could see that with last year we studied the Sabbath, right?
And I think that's the argument that we're asking.
Right, so
there's no temple anymore.
I'm
just saying they'd want to get it written down because they're gone. I'm wondering.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you could look in every part of the Talmud and sense that we're grappling with any number of meta issues as a Jewish community as history unfolds for the Jewish people. We sometimes want the reports of exactly what happened in the past so we can be completely contiguous in terms of a line of history. We sometimes bring up an observation about what was done in the past because we know we can no longer do it, and it's the only record we have of it. We sometimes have to face new situations where different texts are arguing with our own, or different philosophies and philosophers are at odds with us. You know, so there's no doubt that this Masechta goes right along with the rest of the Gemara's project in that reality. No two ways about it. And it recognizes right from the start that tension explicitly. When we lived in our land, maybe this law applied and we could do 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. But now that we're not in our land and we're dealing with diaspora reality, what is it we're going to do? Are we going to do what Rabbi Akiva suggested? Is that still going to keep us together as a people for celebrating Purim? Still read 11, 12, 13 because of the drosh b'zmanehem? Or are we going to limit it? You know, so does that address the question?
It addresses the question that if you let go of one thing, it may come to another.
Well, right. And if you let go of one thing, for sure it becomes another. And rabbinic productivity is all about creating the proper rituals in their times, new restrictions and new possibilities. They see it as restrictions as well as possibilities.
The Book of Esther is particularly relevant to this, in this discussion, because it's a diaspora book, quintessential diaspora book. It takes place, the whole plot, the whole ambiance of the book is outside of the land of Israel. It takes place in another place with another people, with not people who are in Judea. Palestine. They're away. They're someplace else. They're in diaspora.
Right, and by bringing us right in the first Mishnah and right now on 2b to the place where we read from the Megillah in walled cities on the 15th, but walled cities not in the time of Shushan, from the time of Yoshua ben Nun, where the greatest miracle wrought for the Jewish people happened, where God handed over the land of Israel to his people, where the promise was fulfilled, right? We're now like creating a certain sense of the overlay of Zion and the accomplishment of Kibush Haaretz, of the conquering of the land on the diaspora, perhaps, or in our diaspora reality, a setup to compare and contrast our existence as a Jewish community in diaspora lands versus our once glorious and could be in the future community of Israel in Zion. Listen to the distinction. I'm either overlaying it and I'm feeling like I'm a member and a citizen of Zion wherever I go, or I'm contrasting it and I'm paying the price for it. And that is something that we can see happen all over the Gemara as well. And we saw that with the Shabbat chapter we learned, because in certain parts of Israel you had certain types of foods, and in certain parts of diaspora you had other parts of foods, and could I eat the fish if it was a diaspora fish? Or some of the comments that we said about some of the meals and the questions about celebrating the Sabbath. Really important questions.
Do we know when Megillah was written, by whom, what time? Because this discussion is like 1,000 years after the event.
Right. You're talking...
Oh, because I loved it, so it wasn't there.
Yes. Look, you're talking about
1,000 years.
You're talking about
a
question of authorship. You're talking about extant translations of the Megillah. That, you know, we don't know which is the Ur text. We say that our Bible is a written tradition handed to us. We kind of see that Esther is, you know, 6th century BCE already, the story's unfolding, and according to tradition.
Yeah, but the Sasanians don't come along until about 200.
Well, this is Sasanian.
AD.
This is Sasanian, right.
Is around,
yeah, and that's what we're saying. The Gemara itself is talking about these things.
The Sasanians get to their height of power in 600.
Right, much later. We're talking about Sasanian. But, you know, ancient Persia, we're talking about those times.
1,000 years.
So what time is that? Is there someone we identify as Ahasuerus?
I don't feel entirely like I should present a critical history of the Megillah here and now, but I can prepare something from a couple of different thinkers regarding the matter, and I'm happy to hand that out. But what I want to do is, before we leave tonight, I would like to just push through a little bit more of the text and get us back into the kind of where this discussion leads. And the Gemara poses yet another challenge to the scriptural derivation presented above. So it says, Ve'ema prazim ba'ar besar, but one could say that unwalled cities celebrate Purim on the 14th, mukafin, and the residents of walled cities may choose when, to celebrate Purim, according to the tradition of how to read that part of the Gemara. Ibahu bar Beisar. If they want to celebrate on the 14th, they do that. Ibahu b'chamesar. And if they want, they can celebrate on the 15th. Ba'u, in this case, bet ayin vav, is the Aramaic for ratsu. They want, they desire. Gemara rejects that possibility, that the choice is really in their hands. Amar kra bizmanehem. Oh, back to this verse that I'm familiar with. Bizmanehem. I'm going to see the word bizmanehem. The verse says in their times, which teaches what? Zmano shelzeh lo zmano shelzeh. The time for this walled city is unlike the time for the other unwalled cities, meaning the walled and unwalled cities must celebrate Purim on separate days. Consequently, the time designated for walled cities cannot include the 14th of Adar, inasmuch as that is the day when Purim is celebrated in unwalled cities. Now, what happens right there for us in terms of this hermeneutical question that we asked before?
Are they using another meaning of...
So what we said was is that it doesn't stop them. It doesn't stop them from offering another source that uses the word that learns the possibility that, at least at that point in the argumentation, is offered with its proof text being a verse that they even said, or another sage said, you can't use it for that because I need it for this. So that exists as a possibility. One could say, but did I not have a Gemara sage, a sage of the Gemara, argue already that that verse was necessary for a different tradition? One might think that that might come up here, but it doesn't have to work that way. The aim of Bataleasar, but one could say that in walled cities, Purim is celebrated on the 13th of Adar. You could go back and say the 13th. Gemara says, okay. But what basis is there really for saying the 15th? That's the standing question. Kishushan, the Gemara answers, you know, we have this thing in the Megillah, we have this description in the Megillah, presumably walled cities celebrate Purim on the same day as the city of Shushan. Since the verse is given no date for walled cities, we assume that they celebrate Purim on the 15th, the day when the residents of Shushan celebrated after defeating their enemies. And that is mentioned in verse 18 of chapter 9 in the Megillah. Now, what have we done by this point? Didn't we say that the Mishnah held that the city we base our reading practice on, vis-a-vis walls, was what? Walled cities in the time of Joshua.
So we don't know this stuff about Shushan.
But didn't we just say that it's a little bit more like when the Jews of Shushan celebrated their Purim?
Shushan was walled, right?
Yeah, but the rabbis... Exactly, because Shushan at the time is not walled. At least that's got to be the assumption here. Here, in the Megillah. Megillah. Time of Joshua, they assume it is. Time of Joshua, we assume it is. Here, so all things point to... There are gates. Doesn't necessarily have to mean that it's fully walled. And even if they were some remnants of walls, what do we concern ourselves with by way of the Mishnah? Which walls?
Israel.
The ones in Israel. The ones in the time of Joshua. And we have to know, like, right? Because that's really what we're talking about when we say the times of Joshua and the association is to the great overcoming of Jericho. But here, at this point in the Gemara, just for where we're holding, for a minute, we're back to, oh, but they're going to be able to read on the 15th based on what? Based on the fact that that's the day that the Jews of Shushan really celebrated. And Shushan, and what's going on in Shushan, becomes, at this moment, even if it's just for a moment, the epicenter versus any kind of city that we have hanging there, even though we have hanging in our minds that we are discussing cities that were walled in the time of Yehoshua ben Nun. And so we have the diaspora Israel tension. We have the currency of what Jews did in this age versus that age, and the glory of Jewish, really in a certain way, Jewish power, both in terms of times of Joshua and in times of Shushan, where they were able to fight their own battle. And either way, it's linked to that, you know, in terms of any celebration of Purim. So at this point in the Gemara, want to give special kind of attention to both this narrative of what went on in the days of Purim, narrative of what went on in the sixth book. Remember, I said this the other day at Tfilot, if you were at services, if you call the sixth book after the five books of Moses, the sixth book where Joshua truly is able to go and conquer the land, and we have some culmination of, you know, Jewish, at least the promise held out by God through the power of Joshua in combination with the priests, that Jewish priestliness and religious Leviticalness and Joshua's army and Jewish power come to the aid of the Jewish people and then ultimately lead to Kibush Haaretz and the inheritance of the land and the conquering of the land. And you have this kind of moment here where through some great plan of the divine, even where the divine's not named in the Megillah, the Jews in unwalled cities and walled cities, or unwalled cities and Shushan at the time of Purim itself, have really overcome their enemies. And now we know that it's 15th and not the 13th, and that's where we're holding.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Good to learn together. Yeah, sure. This is the Art Scroll, Tractate Megillah.
M-E-G-I-L-L-A-H.